Ladies and gentlemen, with due respect to Steve Tonser, who I understand invented the term post-liberal, this is, in my judgment, not a post-liberal age, but a period of suicidal mental epidemic. The facts are quite clear. The latest information, official out of Washington, is that the ICBM submarine launched ballistic missile launchers and bombers, in other words, the launchers of the Soviet Union, in total are about 1,800 against 2,300 of the United States. The closing rate is such that the USSR will overtake us late in 1972, but don't bet on it, it could be a lot faster. In terms of ICBM launchers by themselves, the Soviets have reached superiority over us. If you are surprised to hear that, I am surprised that you would be surprised, because this has been in the coming for the last 3 or 4 years. Everybody who knows anything about the business wrote about it. In fact, it was basically presented to Congress. Nothing was done about it. But anyway, the figures as of today are about we have something like 1,050 ICBMs, including quite a few old ones. And the Soviet Union has about 1,500 ICBMs, including quite a few new ones, to which you have to add about 750 MRBMs, because they are all there that are needed to hit London or Bonn or Madrid even, or Tokyo, which of course are strategic missiles, to which you can add about 500 so-called scaleboard missiles, which are really short-range sort of trans-tactical weapons. So you have something like close to 3,000 missiles on the Soviet side. This leaves off a discussion of the yields of the various weapons. It leaves off the question of accuracy, leaves off the question of multiple warheads, all of which is very interesting in it. Technical discussion, no point, however, to complicate things here. I must add, however, that the American statistics are a little rosy, because the B-52s are obsolescent, at the very least, if not obsolete, because our launch sites in many ways are vulnerable to a first strike. On the other hand, we do have a warning system which I don't know whether it's reliable or not, but it is at least pretty good. And the Soviets are therefore not really quite sure whether we release our force before they hit us. In other words, we have a short period of about 10 minutes to decide when the missiles come. Do we counter-strike immediately, or are we going to get in one of our interminable discussions whether these are radar blips and not missiles? The problem, which they don't know, and which I don't know, and you don't know, is how the particular president at the particular moment will decide. And perhaps it's just as well that no one knows, because this is one of the things which a military planner really has to know. And if he doesn't know, because no one else knows, including the president, who has to make the decision, well, that puts a cramp on the particular planner. That is, at this stage, ladies and gentlemen, our last rampart of security, this particular uncertainty. Now, the USSR, to repeat this, is growing in strategic strength, our strength, essentially. There are, again, if you go into some of the details, there are some facts to be said about changes, but essentially our strength is static. There are two conclusions which have to be drawn from those basic facts. One is that the USSR does not have a first strike capability today, in the sense that while they have superiority, they would get too much in return if we strike back at all. But by 1975, in this general time frame, they could launch a first strike against us without any serious risk of being hurt themselves. I might want to make this point very, very clear, because people always bathe in this false security of thinking that nuclear war necessarily is mutually destructive. If it is mutually destructive, it won't happen. It will happen if it is destructive on one side only, or predominantly on one side. Now, that's the first conclusion. The second conclusion is that the USSR has a deterrent capability now, and this means that if they decide to take, or risk to take, if you want to put it this way, Europe, European NATO, and Japan, or Japan, they can do so. If there's an attack on Germany and France today, an American decision to strike back by nuclear means is practically out of question. And of course, you don't have to fool yourselves to think that the Germans don't know this, and the French don't know this, and the Soviets don't know that. They all know it. Now, to put that into perspective with respect to what's happening in Germany today, you see that the Soviets really are quite cautious. They operate to take over Germany by political warfare, and I won't waste my time spelling out for you what the fall of West Germany would mean. Now, there are arguments that, of course, the Soviets won't strike, or they don't want to exploit their superiority. All this is a little bit like the blushing maiden who invites these very virile and aggressive suitor to see her new etchings, because she knows he will behave. Also reminds me of this old proverb that dogs who bark don't bite, and the rejoinder, as you know, from times immemorial was, you know it, I know it, but does the dog know it? So if you really analyze the logic of all these things in the perspective of history as we all have known it, as all the historians have written it down, the question is, did we lose our survival instinct? And the answer I will try to give to you in the good Harvard Business School in 7 cases. First of all, let me give you case number 1. LBJ, in 1965, decided against explaining the Vietnam War to the American people on the grounds that he didn't want to have a war hysteria on hand which would force him to go to Hanoi. And who wants to go to Hanoi, which I agree with, but who wants to knock out communist systems? If we do that, we lose the basis for our mutual adjustment with the Soviet Union. You can analyze that a little further if you want to. So anyway, he covered up deliberately what the facts of life in North Vietnam and in communist countries are, and the entire American apparatus of public information on those matters was dismantled. It so happens that Mr. Nixon has perpetuated Mr. Johnson's decision, and it is still true today that the information about what threatens us, why should we fight communism, what is the world situation all about, this apparatus no longer exists. I just call your attention to the fact that you can check, for example, on the number of books which are published on the subject, and you will get the point. Let me give you another example. That's the second case, the case of drugs. Now, the evidence is rather overwhelming that a major proportion, something like probably 80%, of all the heroin, which is the deadly drug, the real deadly drug, heroin, you live 6 years, maybe 10, and that's the end of it. Most of the time you live 2 years. Well, the heroin comes out of Red China. There again, you can persuade yourself of this brutal fact very easily. Heroin is an opium derivative, but where the opium comes from doesn't really particularly matter, because you can produce it. You have to have a production facility, not a very complicated production, but you still need some sort of an industry for a large output. Now, we put all the production in France, around the Marseille area. You just take your little pencil and scribble this out, how much production there could be, and it is obvious that the French production doesn't cover the field. And the only other heroin industry in the world, which we know the locations of and all that, is in China. And there is a whole lot of evidence showing that there is a terrific stream of heroin coming out of the funnel in Southeast Asia through Hong Kong and so on. I don't think that the United States government doesn't know about it. And you can again persuade yourself very easily on that by reading the book by former Narcotics Commissioner Anslinger and our presentations which he conducted in the UN about the heroin infection organized by the Chinese against Japan in the early 50s. The facts of the Chinese heroin production were quite often commented upon by American representatives in the UN Narcotics Commission up to about the middle 60s, at the very time, incidentally, when the narcotics offensive started against the United States, which you can date in place to Berkeley, January 1965, whereupon in February 1965, the big escalation of the war began in Vietnam. Just leave that to you to meditate about it instead of reading all this claptrap about psychology of the behavioral and psychological factors underlying the drug epidemic we have in the United States. Now, the ties between drugs and communist China, and conversely, the fact that the heroin take is used to finance the secret apparatus of the Red Chinese, is basically clear. The United States government has been completely covering up this fact, and I leave it to you to connect this with the present agitation for the acceptance of Red China into the UN. I may add that there are about 13 international treaties against drug production and drug traffic. Number three. What do the following gentlemen have in common? Mr. Ho Chi Minh, Mr. Nasser, Mr. Mao Zedong, Mr. Sukarno, and Mr. Sihanouk, if you still remember some of those. The pains in the neck of American foreign policy in the post-World War period. Well, they have in common that every one of them was put into power by the United States. I won't go into explaining this in detail on the basis of the documents which are available, but you can find out yourself without too much trouble. Point number four, what do the following gentlemen have in common? Mr. Diem, Mr. Trujillo, and Mr. Franz Josef Strauss. Well, they have in common that the United States kicked them out of their positions. Some of them feed first. Now, the Diem interlude brought us into Vietnam. The Trujillo interlude brought us into San Domingo, which also, as you may recall, was a fairly substantial crisis. And the ouster of Mr. Strauss from the Defense Ministry in Germany, which was maneuvered by Mr. McNamara, I may add, just in case you need a more complete dossier on the gentleman. That particular ouster has essentially ruined NATO, which today no longer is worthwhile talking about, really. And again, NATO being what it is, Germany is on the brink of a takeover. Hope it won't work, I don't predict it. Now, Mr. Nixon, this is point number five, hasn't played that particular game of putting people in and out yet. Oh, I beg your pardon, I forgot to mention a very important gentleman who was put in by the United States, Mr. Castro. Just don't ignore him. So let's go back to Mr. Nixon and case number five. He hasn't yet played this sort of thing. But Mr. Castro was put in under the Eisenhower administration. So the Republicans don't have a very clean and white discussion on this sort of matter. But today, we are getting very close to making somewhat similar changes with our China policy. I again won't spell it out. The United States policy on the Sino-Soviet conflict, which is a very real conflict, which is a very deadly conflict, which has many positive and negative implications for us. But the obvious policy of the United States should be to exploit this particular conflict to our advantage, I would think. I know we Our policy is not to exploit it to our advantage, which would be to weaken communism, but apparently we are moving to exploit it toward the stabilization of Maoism. Now, if that isn't the crowning stupidity of all the cases which preceded, I don't know what would be the superlative on it. But I think this is it. And we're just about to do it. Case number 6. It's a minor one, but a typical one. It deals with Mr. Sekou Touré, the avowed communist ruler of Guinea, and Portuguese Guinea, which is adjoining Guinea. All Guineas, it's a little hard to distinguish, but there's a Portuguese Guinea and then there's the big Guinea. Sekou Touré plays his own game. The communists in the East don't insist on exact orthodoxy in his case, so he plays the Soviets and the Chinese, but in any event, he plays the game against us. Also, there's fairly good evidence that he isn't quite right up in the head. But irrespective of that, there has been a guerrilla war based on Guinea against Portuguese Guinea for about 10 years. Now, this isn't my interpretation. If you want to persuade yourself of that one, read the Bible of all these events, the Tricontinental Journal, which is published in Havana, which gives you all the data and all the basic facts, including that, for example, in that same year of 1965, when we had the drug offensive in Vietnam and the attempt against Indonesia, well, there was also a stepping up in the guerrilla war over there in West Africa, inasmuch as suddenly heavy equipment such as mortars and so on got into place. Where they came from, I don't know, but you have three guesses, and probably one of them is going to be correct. Now, in November last year, a few months ago, there was a sudden outcry which Mr. Secretary went to the UN and said that great aggression is being waged against him, and the Portuguese launched the aggression. By the time the week was over, it was the South Africans, it was the West Germans, it was NATO, it was the United States, and God knows who else was in that particular aggression. And he was crying bloody murder, and there was a Security Council meeting. And a commission was appointed to investigate the case. Now, it seems to have been true that there was a raid by someone, which came probably from Portuguese Guinea, which doesn't necessarily mean, under the conditions that the Portuguese government was involved, to liberate prisoners, about 250, from the Portuguese area, imprisoned in the Guinean area under Sekou Touré. Now, how the hell did these prisoners get into Guinea, into jail there? Well, that's, of course, quite simple. They were captured by these many guerrilla wars, and they were put back and were left there, and finally someone decided to liberate these guys. And the coup was connected with a operation intra-Guinea, in which people working in the entourage of Sekou Touré rebelled against him, and a few tribes also rebelled against his regime. In other words, it was a raid, and whether this was accidental, that it was coordinated with an uprising against the Touré regime or not, I don't know. But it did happen, and again, the evidence in this is quite clear, because the second in command of Mr. Touré, a fellow who has the very pretty name of Bill Sow, Bill Sow was executed, and a few other people too. And there were, incidentally, about 70 executions in connection with this, including a few Europeans, preceded by torture in similar cases, and not a word was said about it. Now, the Kangaroo Committee, which investigated this case, came back with a finding based on absolutely fabricated evidence or non-evidence, in which Portugal was accused of aggression. The United States endorsed, in a way, together with Britain, the report, which was an absolutely phony report. It should never have endorsed the report on the simple grounds that the report was composed by a procedure which, I repeat the word, can only be described as a kangaroo court. There was no proper taking of testimony. Now, we accept this sort of thing in the UN when we wouldn't think of one half a second to accept this in the case like the Manson murder trial. Double standard thinking. Now, we abstained from voting, but we did not cast a veto in the Security Council. And according to the present practice in the UN, which is, of course, a violation of the charter, abstention counts as zero vote, and therefore the condemnation of Portugal was passed. This led to a terrific propaganda campaign against Portugal, Germany, NATO, and the United States. In other words, you see here an American policy which is not only false in objective observation, which is also self-destructive in our own interest, because we have absolutely no interest to weaken our allies, which is what we do in this case. I'm not saying that the Portuguese act right or wrong. This is an entirely different problem. You have to look at the case itself. We weaken ourselves instead of making sure that the fellow like Secretary Ray gets kicked out of the traffic pattern. If you can put in Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong and Nasser, and you can kick out Diem and Franz Josef Strauss, by God, I think you can also kick out Mr. Secretary Ray, don't you think so? But the trouble would be that if we kick out Mr. Secretary Ray, it would perhaps help our interests if it doesn't happen. The case number 7, the last one, that's South Africa. Again, before I get into this, let me say whether you think South Africa is guilty of only 10% of the crimes which are charged to it, or 100% doesn't make any difference at all. Mr. Manson, I think, is quite guilty of a lot of crimes, but the legal process is applied irrespective of what the defendant stands for. So we have to look at the legal procedure itself. Now, it so happens that we have been running a vendetta against South Africa on the basis of the mandate, the League of Nations mandate in Southwest Africa, dating back to the Eisenhower administration. Again, let me stress this, because it doesn't pay to put all the dirt on the Democrats when actually the Republicans just share the same mentality with them. They could maybe be doing it a little differently, but it's fundamentally the same thing. And the same vendetta started roughly when we were helping Mr. Castro to power. So there's a period after Dulles' departure where things got very wrong in Washington. Now, the case is up to the court, International Court of Justice again today, and the United States has embarked as practically the only power in the world to defend the revocation of the mandate by the UN for the purpose of evicting the government of South Africa from the mandated territory of Southwest Africa. And it went there together with two other main promoters of this idea, one being the Secretary General of the United Nations, the other one the Organization of African Solidarity. The Secretary, incidentally, departed from his role as being an impartial official of the international organization and clearly took a partisan position. Now, the point I want to stress here is this. The United States went to the court, presented a brief of about 100 pages, and in this brief, it provided a description of the policy of South Africa. Now, you would think that it's quite kosher and proper. The only trouble with it is that the document on which the policy of South Africa was to be explained was a forged and fabricated document. Now, you have to think this thing through. This, again, let me repeat, has nothing to do with South Africa itself. The United States, the promoter of international law, Andrew Carnegie, spent the money to build the Peace Palace in The Hague. Our whole policy is based on the idea that law should gradually replace force. We go to court on the signature of the United States government with a brief in which we present the forged document. Just think about it. Now, think about also this other fact that this document would have never passed by the State Department if the fellows who had to sign out on the dotted line to pass it on to the UN had known what the policy of South Africa is. Because if you notice, you immediately see the document is a forgery. Let's look at it for 1 second only from the strategic interests of the United States. If South Africa goes out of Southwest Africa, who goes in? It's a question which we must ask ourselves, don't we? Well, start out with who pays the budget. The present budget is about $200 million. In other words, it exceeds the total budget of the UN. Now, who do you think is going to have to shell out the $200 million? Which at present is being paid by South Africa. Who will get in is set by the UN to be the UN. But the UN is a fiction. Now, do you really suppose that only Americans and Englishmen may get in and the Soviet Union will not get in? Do you really suppose that the Chinese will not try to muzzle in if we in the meantime put them into the UN? And do you really suppose that if that happens, this improves the security of the Atlantic or the Indian Ocean areas? And I trail off at this point. I think you get it. I don't have to enlarge on it. Not the case, it isn't worth to call it the case, is Mr. Nixon's statement on peace, which he made 2 weeks ago. It is his own. You can't blame it on any underling in the State Department. If it is a demagogic statement, you know, he wants to be the great prince of peace. Lots of princes of peace have trailed through history. It is bad demagoguery, and it will inevitably backfire. If it is his honest conviction, then I must say, frankly, that I prefer Tricky Dick to a naive and illusionist president. Now, that is part of the record. Obviously, we can go on for hours. Let me try to summarize it in 4 findings. First, United States Foreign Policy Organization, strictly from the governmental organization point of view, is utterly anomic. The president's job is too big. He doesn't have time to think about his primary job, which is that of security. He's isolated. Henry Kissinger sees to that on a day-by-day basis that he remains isolated. As a result of this, American foreign policy is handled by anonymous staff people, usually on the level of lieutenant colonels and the equivalents in the diplomatic service. These people are good people, many of them, others are not so good, but obviously they don't have the adequate experience, information, knowledge, wisdom, and perspective. In any event, it is an anonymous product by many cooks, and it tastes like it. Number 2, and that is slightly more optimistic, the situation is endemic not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. And the signs specifically that it is just as endemic in the Kremlin and in Peking are rather persuasive. The human condition, in other words, is tied to this particular political condition, namely that people are apparently unable to adopt and run a rational foreign policy. Heraclitus said that everything flows, panterai, but everything may flow, but nothing really changes. Improvements seem impossible, hence history will continue as usual, and catastrophes are preventable only by miracle. I think that is a position which shouldn't surprise you as conservatives. Man is man, and it stays there. And all the great dreams with which we have entered the post-World World War II period are just a bunch of utopian thinking, works for a little while, and then it settles back. And all this you can find if want to read them up on this Aristotle, but it's just the fact that it doesn't change. Let's face it. Finding number 3, the threat with which we have been concerned is a communist revolution worldwide executed by nuclear arms, subversion, and brainwashing. We have elected, in face of this threat, not to prevail, nor even to defend ourselves. Now, if you say our words disprove this statement, you're right. I put it to you, if you are a modern social scientist and you are a behaviorist, look at the American behavior and you will see this statement is more or less correct. Finding number four, we also have decided to carry out revolutions from above ourselves, the revolutions of liberalism. And the examples I have given, if you sum up the essence of their meaning, is that we are engaged actively on promoting revolutionary events abroad. We don't know quite when, how, why, what we want to achieve. It's all in a complete mist of confusion, but revolutionaries we are. These are, mind you, not revolutions against communist totalitarianism, but they are revolutions against everybody else, especially against our friends. You can mull that one over. And connected with this, incidentally, there's a submerged effort to transform the UN through reinterpretation of the Charter into something like a mild world government, which perhaps could do things, the nature of which I will refer to in a second. This particular policy resembles that of De Gaulle's secret design. De Gaulle, he never wrote this up publicly, but he has made the statement to several people. And the statement runs something like this: since communism is bound to win, not because it's better, but because the free world is decrepit and decadent, the obligation of the French president is to make the transition as easy and painless as possible. I put it to you, that is applicable to the policy of the United States. Now, if I misinterpret the secret design in Washington, then there is no design and there is no strategy, but a mere muddling through decisions on a day-by-day basis, most of which are not precisely based on total ignorance, but on partial ignorance. And this ignorance is furthermore permeated by illusions, which are in turn derived from a false, that is, an ideological philosophy. We no longer know what we stand for, hence we don't want to persevere, not to preserve what we have, but instead we have an escapism, which is to try to build a future utopian world. Now, fortunately, in all that, human folly doesn't necessarily increase or decrease. History is not predetermined. Communism is also eroding and doing a fairly good job at it. Our social order, as was pointed out in the discussion yesterday, still stands. And though it is unconscious of its own power and its obvious survival, this fact is of great importance. The free market is spreading and is quite successful, even in the USSR, which is a subject by itself, but I want to mention it. Changes there in this direction are significant. So perhaps we can get by. And perhaps we will still come to our senses. But at the best complexion you can put on things, we have today a strategy of rhetoric, nothing else. And the rhetoric is designed to humor the mental epidemic which we are undergoing at the present moment. In any event, it is one hell of a way going about our business. Let me close with a quotation by a man who usually isn't quoted in learned circles, the great Spanish painter Goya. The sleep of reason produces monsters. And if you want to have a pictorial impression of that, look at the particular picture which he has designed. So, and you probably will end up being slightly frightened of what is in store. Thank you very much.